The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benbrut from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, a team of volunteer readers will be reading short science fiction stories. We call our program Science Fiction Shorts, and it will be available in podcast after the broadcast.
I'm Sonia Usach-Kuhn, and I'm going to read The History of the World in Four Sentences by Liam Hogan.
"The history of the world?" the old man growled, his ruined teeth a horror show in what little moonlight filtered through the dense leaves and branches above. "What do you want that old chestnut of a story for?"
The child, the last born human, though neither she nor the old man nor anyone else knew that, sucked on her thumb before piping.
"Want to hear how we began, how great we was, what our ancestors did wrong, and what our future is, please?" "Kid, we ain't got no future."
The child's great-grandfather was right about that, doubly so on a personal level. His old bones would be scattered by wolves before the snows returned. Still, he relented, as he always did, as the child knew he would.
"The earth was a paradise. Man came along. Man died out. The earth was a paradise again. Now go to sleep."
The child pouted unseen. She preferred the other version, the older, longer one, the one the old man used to tell when they would light a fire to scare away the dark and talk into the long night. Of how Adam and Eve were born in the forest of Eden, how they chopped down the very first tree and unleashed evil into the world, how at one point there were more people than trees, though that was surely impossible, and how they'd even chopped down trees on the moon. But the tide had turned. The more men there were, the less room there was for trees. And foolish man needed trees to stay alive, to prevent disease. Once man had poisoned, choked, and strangled his own kind, the planet shrugged him off, almost overnight. Now it began the slow process of healing, which would go on long after the last traces of the ancient road they were following vanished, after the last lamppost was engulfed by kudzu, pulled down by creepers, long after the only traces that man had ever existed were fossils trapped in rock. That was the version the child preferred. But the old man didn't say another word.
My name is Larry Bliss. I'll be reading Futures by David Bate. Jack gets the animal home to his apartment and sets it on the counter in the kitchen. Then he just stands there watching it. He's sure there's no such thing as whatever this is. It doesn't even look like an animal, really, now that he thinks about it. More like something out of a fairy tale. It has wide, trusting eyes and a body like a stuffed toy. Jack puts a hand out, and the animal nuzzles its head into his palm. Its fur feels like lamb's wool on his fingers. The woman who sold it to Jack had another dozen, maybe 20 animals, Jack had never seen before. Starting again with that paragraph. The woman who sold it to Jack had another dozen, maybe 20 animals Jack had never seen before. She was old and warty and smoking a pipe. Sitting there in the shadows between the crates and the cages, she looked exactly like the kind of person who would own a magical pet store. It kind of ruined the moment when she spoke with a thick Brooklyn accent. "Sure, buddy. Have a look around. Mi casa, su casa, you know? No pictures, though, okay? You know how it is, man. Got to protect my investments." Jack went from cage to cage, each animal more adorable than the last. small furry things purring and cooing, reaching through the bars to hold his fingers, their big eyes begging him to take them home. Jack decided on the spot to buy one, right then, no matter what it cost him. How could you find a shop full of strange and, let's face it, probably magical creatures, and not take one home? Jack found one he liked and called over his shoulder to the old woman. How much for this one? $2,000. They're all $2,000. Jack flinched. It would empty out his savings. He stood there a moment, pursing his lips, but he already knew it didn't matter. I'll take it. Oh, yeah? He heard the old woman say. Which one? This one. Jack checked the handwritten label on the side of the cage. Super Bowl quarterback. He stopped after he had said it and checked he'd read it right, but that's what it said. You've got it, Buster. Bring that bad boy over here. Jack checked the labels on the other cages. Oscar-winning actor. Best-selling author. Nobel Prize for physics. Then he bought his animal in its cage to the counter. What's with the labels? But the lady just looked at his purchase. You only get the animal, pal. You can't keep my cage. Oh, sorry, sure. What's with the labels? This one says Super Bowl quarterback. Sure, the old woman shrugged. You buy this dongwu if you want to be a quarterback in a Super Bowl. She held up a finger in ominous warning. It doesn't say you win, buddy. Don't come back here wanting your money back if you lose. That's on you throwing interceptions or whatever. But wait, Jack tried to understand this. Are you saying I buy this thing and I become a pro football player? Only if you buy this one. Each of the dongwu do something different. Jack just stood there. It was beyond far-fetched, but then he was standing in a shop full of magical creatures. The far-fetched ship had sailed. The old woman leaned across the counter and grinned. So what do you want to be, buddy? A rock star? A banker? The president? I got them all. Anything you want, and we'll hook you up. And that's how Jack came home with the smallest, cutest, most innocent-looking dongwu in the shop. All its tag said was power. Jack stares at the dongwu on his kitchen counter. It nuzzles his hand some more and looks up at him. If he didn't know better, Jack would swear it's smiling at him. It looks so helpless, it makes Jack's gut twist into a knot. He feels a little bit sick of thinking about what the old woman said when he carried the dongwu in his arms out of the shop. When you get home, pal, kill the dongwu and eat it. Jack looked back at her, horrified. What? Crush its head with something. Doesn't matter what, just bash it. Their skulls are really fragile. They break like an egg, and then their skin comes off super easy. After that, you just fry it in a pan, maybe some garlic or something. But it doesn't matter, really. You do that and eat it, and you'll have your future, for sure. Jack cradled the dongwu and felt it shivering in his arms. Are you crazy? This is one of a kind. Why would I kill it? The old woman shrugged. That's how it works, man. She grinned at him again. A friendly grin, but something about it was mean. Look, don't be so squeamish. You want to be a big shot, right? You want to be rich? You want women to adore you? This is what it takes. And think about it. When you have what you want, you won't even remember that little critter there. Or, she shrugged coyly, have a cute pet and a normal life. Your choice. Jack lets the dongwu bury its head into his right hand. With his left, he feels along the counter for something heavy and hard enough.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and I'll be reading Spirit Board by DJ Kozlowski. It's not real. The Ouija board rested between them, six hands still resting on the planchette. It can't be real. There's no such thing as ghosts or spirits. The other two girls sat silently, staring at Kelly as she spoke. We're the ones controlling it. Like, we must be. I mean, it's our fingers on the thingy. And I admit, I've been pushing it a bit. Like when we ask the spirit who it likes, I sort of guided the thingy to B-L-A-I-N-E, because I like Blaine. But you guys were pushing it too. Kelly couldn't believe how naive these girls were. She lifted the board, forcing the girls' hands to fall to their laps. See, it's just wood. There's nothing special about it. Just wood with a sticker on top. And the sticker has the letters and numbers and yes and no, but we are in control. I think usually nobody admits to controlling it, so it's all spooky. But look at this thing. She held up the planchette. It's plastic. Even the glass part is plastic. Light from the candles reflected on the planchette's faux glass dome, through which the letters on the board were typically viewed. The air smelled heavily of apple. One of the candles was fat, red, and included apple oil. In the dimly lit, apple-scented room, neither of the other girls spoke. They just sat there, frozen. The redhead had her mouth open slightly. Her freckles danced around her pale skin as the candles fluttered with Kelly's every movement. The other girl's short, dark hair framed her face, casting her features in shadow. Only the echo of light glinted from her eyes behind a few stray strands. Hey, listen, she couldn't recall the dark-haired girl's name. Why couldn't she remember her name? How odd. Maybe she was suffering memory loss. Some kind of temporary amnesia from the stupid light-as-a-feather, stiff-as-a-board game, where her friends dropped her from waist-high onto the wooden floor. She remembered banging her head hard. The girls still stared at her. It was getting annoying. Did they really believe in this stupid game? She was getting agitated now. Kelly looked at the two, who were now holding hands. What the hell, you guys? You need to stop. You're creeping me out. Her mind wandered. Kelly had never believed in ghosts. She knew she was the one controlling the game. She made it go to the letters and numbers, yes and no, as appropriate. The other girls had to know she was doing it. They must have known all along. Why were they being so weird? Seriously, you know it was me, right? You guys had the thing moving slowly, then I added my hands and it started moving with, like, a purpose. Like it wasn't just going around, it was moving toward letters. When you asked the spirit's name, I'm the one who moved it to K-E-L. She stopped.
This is Steve Lord reading A Hero I Am by Cat Otis. I am a hero. Heroes are brave, selfless, and kind. They never skip the village's weekly archery practice, or fight with their fathers about it while they're supposed to be quietly stalking deer. They don't freeze when the bandits come pouring into the clearing, don't run and hide as their father bleeds and screams his last. They never get lost in the old north wood, and they certainly don't cry themselves to sleep in a bed of moss. When heroes discover something wrong in this world, they show their courage by making a plan to fix it. They never cower in the darkest woods they can find. going from hungry to starving and desperately wishing they hadn't neglected their archery and woodcraft. They don't prioritize snaring a rabbit over finding a way home. They certainly never despair of anyone coming to help them and vow from now on to only help themselves. If a hero finds a bandit with a broken leg in their pit trap, they calmly secure him and bring him back to the village to face justice. They never fall shivering to the leaf-carpeted ground, or vomit back up what little food they'd managed to find. They don't grow angry at his taunts about their abandonment of their father, or if they do, they do not show it. And they certainly never take up their bow in shaking hands and need 3 arrows to kill him while he lays helpless. Heroes who are hunted by bandits come up with clever plans to turn the tables and capture the bandits in return. They don't hunt the bandits for the cover of the treetops instead of facing them in a fair fight. At least, not after they've evened the odds. They never fail to be moved when a bandit no older than themselves begs for mercy. And if any died, it would be because of their own treachery. It is certainly not because the hero planned from the start to kill them all. When heroes return home, they tell everyone the tale of their triumph. They don't flinch from the blood and vomit still staining their weak old clothing. They never wake up sobbing in the night because they didn't do enough, didn't act sooner. And they certainly never slink away from their village in the middle of the night because they can no longer stand their neighbor's pity. That is not my story, because I am a hero. A hero. I am.
My name is Jennifer Green, and I will be reading The Second Julia. Marcos, I hate you, reverberates along my electric synapses. His door slams shut behind him, rattling in its frame. See, Pilar says, I told you it was too soon. We should have waited till he's 12. He already suspected, though. I sit across from the woman whom my memories say is my wife, but those memories are older than Marco, and aside from the first few months when I was novel and Pilar seeking any balm to her grief, she hasn't wanted me. She's only kept me around for Marco and to honor the first Julia. I've stayed for the same reasons. Pilar chews her pancakes ostentatiously. She gets like this sometimes, finds any little way she can to remind me my body isn't human. I can eat, and do to keep up the charade, but the clean-out process after is tedious. Better to avoid the whole process. Julia wanted to wait till he was 12. Pointless to remind Pilar that I'm Julia too. Early on, Pilar went through a phase where she insisted on calling me other names, Juana, Joanna, Judith, never in front of Marco, though he was just a baby then and wouldn't have known the difference, but in private, in texts, on video calls. Whenever I tried to explain that her words hurt, that she was causing harm, she'd spit out another dig that I wasn't human and so couldn't have human feelings. He's a smart kid. He would have figured it out and then resented that we didn't tell him. Pilar stands and dumps the rest of her pancakes, then Marco's, in the recycler. We should have waited for Julia. The house announces that Pilar's auto car has arrived and is on standby to take her to her hospital shift. She strides toward the great room, but then pauses at the threshold. Play it, she says, so soft I think the first Julia's ears wouldn't have heard. I don't rise from my place at the table. It forces Pilar to shift so that I'm in her peripheral vision, but she focuses on the hollow beaming from my left eye, absorbs the sound spewing from my open mouth. Pilar weeps as she places Marco, 4 months old, in my arms. Gurgling and cooing, he reaches for Julia's earring, mine now, where it dangles from my ear. No, no, Pilar says, placing her finger in Marco's way so that he grips it rather than the earring. That'll hurt, an aborted choke. Mommy. Though I only woke up yesterday, the action is instinct. Humming, I plant a kiss on Marco's hair. The lullaby is a fish underwater, part of the ocean's depths, even when unseen from above. Pilar places her hand on my shoulder and rubs the collarbone. She's no longer crying. Another reason why I've stayed. Pilar doesn't request recordings often, but when she does, it's always of me, not the first Julia. Maybe it's the only way she knows to apologize. It's past noon when Marco comes to lurk at the entrance to the living room. I focus on swiping my tablet at regular intervals, as if I'm truly reading. It's best to let him go at his own pace. He scuffs one socked foot along his leg. Tell me what happened to my real mom. I set down the tablet. If I were human, my stomach would be clenching, my throat dry and full. I was designed with tear ducts, though, and Julia's memories, my memories, are enough to set them leaking. I bite back the unhelpful words. I am your real mom. My memories are those of the first Julias. My personality is that of the first Julia. I love Marco just as much as the first Julia, if not more, because I've been here to see him grow and learn and become Marco. But Pilar's reactions taught me to treat the first Julia as a different person rather than myself, so I'm careful to use the third person. Still, I remember the pain, the blood, the treatments that didn't work. She was already sick when you were born 2 months premature. She died 4 months later. But I couldn't stand the thought of not being around for you, so she signed the papers for a cognitive transfer. It ate up all her inheritance. I allow a ghost smile. So you'll have to get a college scholarship or go to a state school. Sorry, kid. Marco's expression doesn't flicker. My smile fades. She wanted me to have the most human-like body possible. Why didn't you tell me before now? Other kids... He snaps his mouth shut. I wince. Marco is smart. Of course his peers are too. Like calls to like. And the times he's had friends over, when they've observed me, maybe made out the near subsonic whirs of servers... What have they been saying to my baby? It hurts. Learning someone you've known all your life isn't what you thought they were. We did what we thought was best, but we were wrong, all three of us, and I'm sorry. Throughout our conversation, he's been drifting closer to the couch. Now he lingers at its arm. Finally, he sits at the very edge of it. Then, after some hesitation, sidles next to me. Slowly, to give him the chance to leave if he wants, I wrap my arm around my son and squeeze. Can you at least do something badass, like shoot lasers from your eyes? It doesn't matter that I don't have a heart. Heart pumps blood, not love. We'll look into some upgrades. Quiet. Then, so soft I almost don't hear it, you're still my mom? My throat is too full, and I swear it, my stomach clenches. I squeeze him tighter. Always. My name is Jennifer Green, and I will be reading Eel Soup by Marge Simon. So, the time has come. He can't stand watching her suffer any longer. He prepares their last meal from scratch. He has procured the vegetables from the neighbor's garden. The onions are still good, as well the carrots and potatoes. A can of stewed tomatoes, peppercorns, and salt, these are in the cabinet. The most important ingredient of all, the eels, he has obtained at the docks early this morning. He is careful to add them with their blood as the soup cools. They are finely chopped and raw, camouflaged with cabbage leaves. A modified and deadly vichyssoise served in her shining silver tureen. He wheels her chair to the table. She's so frail now, her skin almost transparent. The plague that sweeps the world hasn't touched him as yet. Perhaps he is one of the few that are resistant. He frowns at the irony. His own life isn't worth bothering with. But hers is another story. Such talents she has, so much to look forward to. Her paintings were selling well. She had begun composing music to accompany the presentations in galleries. She called it bonding kinetic transitions. But no more. This strain of the virus knows no prejudice. He picks up a photograph of them when they were young, remembers the smell of her wool coat, the way her mouth chokes back a laugh in the photo. She loved his jokes, even the lame ones. Then came a time when laughter stopped, like the sound of her voice, a bare whisper now. Once she'd said his dreams were all smashed up inside. Gray on gray, form without substance, she said. She was the artist. She had dreams for both of them. They are silent during dinner. He offers her another helping. To his surprise, she nods with a lopsided smile. She knows. He turns away to wipe his eyes. After dinner, he helps her out of the wheelchair, lays her gently on the bed. The muscle cramping will begin soon, ending the beating of her heart. But instead of closing her eyes and lying back, she pushes herself up. Hand me that novel you were reading to me last night, sweetheart. I am feeling so much better. I should like to find out how it ends myself. He is stunned. This is the first time she's said entire sentences in many days. And wanting to read? How can this be? Could the eels have cured the virus? Her eyes are bright and her pulse steady. There's a healthy flush to her cheeks that wasn't there before. As he hands her the book, he feels a sharp pain in his stomach as the cramps begin. With a terrible chill, he remembers. It was to be their last meal.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Science Fiction Shorts. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.